Today is Wednesday. It is November 21st, 2018. It's 11:12 in the morning, and this is John Williams. We're the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in beautiful downtown Chicago. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
I'm Justin Kaufman. I'm the co-host of Steve Cochran's show. You can also find and download the podcast on WGN Radio.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the grateful columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
We're going to start with that, Eric. Things we are thankful for. And then we'll just lose our minds like we always do. But let's start on a warm, cheery note, if that's even possible. Justin, I'm looking at you because of the other three, or the other two, I think you're maybe the most capable of accomplishing right. this task. What are you thankful for?
Well, I you know, the easy answer would be family and all of my loved ones. But the real answer is going to be the Comcast remote that you can talk, you know, the one that you don't have to take
the
search.
Xfinity One
the
or something.
The Xfinity where you hit it and you're like, show me Good Place, and it just does it.
Wow.
Also, thin, puffy coats. I think that's something. I'm thankful for that, too.
I'm thankful for journalism. I actually posted this on Facebook and solicited comments, and I continue to ask you to go to my Facebook page, WGN King John. Tell me what you're thankful for. We'll share it on the radio, but I'm thankful for journalism. I'm thankful for Butler basketball, which I talk into my Comcast remote and say Butler basketball, and
it tells me
the channel, and I do that a lot. And I'm thankful for my health, Mr. Zorn.
Well, I'm going to get one of these Comcast remotes. I'm miserable because I don't have one of these remotes.
Oh, by the way, I'm also thankful for how my wife tends to the details in our lives.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
Now back to you.
Oh, now back to you.
Same. Well, wheeled suitcases has to be really high on my list. I mean, can you remember the days before wheeled suitcases?
Do you have the four-wheeled, like the four-direction wheels?
Have
or
both.
The direct,
yeah, we have right. some of the old ones with two wheels, which are vastly inferior to the four.
It's amazing how inferior they are, because right. Brendan and I were going to an airport just recently, and one of us had one of us had the other, and I said, why, when they thought of two, didn't somebody go, let's just see how four works, because it's a game-changer, the four-wheeled
Absolutely.
Suitcase.
Well, and the other thing, this was going to be my recommendation, but I'm going to go with this as something I'm thankful for, which is the Google Translate app. And we were just over in Germany, and we ran into some shirt-tail Zorns over there. And they spoke Russian and German, not much English, and I speak a tiny bit of German. And using this Google Translate app on your phone, you can actually have a relatively decent conversation.
Oh, that's great.
Also, you can read menus. You just hold up the camera, hold up your phone's camera
to
the menu, and it translates in real time.
Wow.
And that talk about a game changer.
Yeah.
The family was there,
my children, those things.
No,
too.
We use that app in Ireland quite a bit.
It's amazing. It's instantaneous.
I have two trips coming up. The one I'm going to recommend is the London and Edinburgh adventure that Steve Bertrand has put together. That'll be at the end of the podcast.
When you come back, I want
Pittsburgh?
You to know it's Edinburgh.
What is it? It's American.
Well, B-U-R-G-H.
It's over there by
Edinburgh.
By Bridgeport, Edinburgh.
So anyway,
Edinburgh.
3 days in England and 3 days in Scotland, right? Sounds like a great trip, John.
Visit SteveBertrandTravel.com. Okay, that's the What Are You Thankful For segment of this week's podcast. Fellas, we were all just crushed by what happened at Chicago Mercy Hospital. And I want to bring it up. It's the first topic on the podcast this week just because it's the most personal, local, and important story that we can talk about. And yet, I'm not exactly sure what to say about it, except here we go again. In fact, the headline of the Tribune editorial was something along those lines, like, okay, now it's Chicago Mercy Hospital. And it was just sort of like, what are we going to do now? And nobody has any solutions other than, we should hug these people and thank them that have survived and do everything we can to keep something like this from happening again, but nobody seems to know what it is. All the old arguments come up. This story is especially searing, I would say, because there does seem to be a certain sanctity of the hospital. That's where we go to patch people up after these massacres, and now some crazy person
yeah.
is shooting people in the hospital.
I saw a report in the news saying that hospitals are one of the worst places for workplace violence. I had no idea that was the case. And it's hard to imagine why that would be true.
I don't remember hearing of. I was a little surprised, to be honest with you, at the amount of attention this got. CNN followed the ambulance and squad cars for a very long time. Live, obviously.
Well, the police
country.
Was it the police procession?
Yeah, I can see.
I mean, I think it got a lot of the attention because, you know, I mean, there are two stories here. There's the story at the hospital, but the other story is the fact that two successive days, a Chicago police officer was shot in this city. You know,
the second time, not fatally. Yeah.
Well, I mean, because he was wearing a vest.
He would have died, but he was wearing a vest.
Right.
I mean, it was.
Right.
And maybe another cop gets killed.
That day, he was shot in his holster.
The bullet lodged in his gun.
I think the outpouring, of course, for the officer, the slain officer, it shows that, you know, there was a lot after the Laquan McDonald stuff about, you know, then you hear this in the political realms that, oh, you know, this people are anti-police and they don't care about the police and see what you've done with this verdict. But we saw an outpouring in the last couple of days, and I think a city beyond politics that was just heartbroken that an officer had fallen this way. And then the other storyline that I think came out of it, and I know Patty and Andrea talked about it this week too, is the domestic violence part of this. This is as much as it gets put into the mass shooting category and one that people can bring up for gun violence and gun control. Domestic violence part of this is just is overlooked sometimes, and I think that's the core of the story.
And Larry Langford at the fire department, right, said he had been kicked out of the fire academy for behavior. So if you're kicked out of a law enforcement, quasi-law enforcement agency for bad behavior, and you're still able to get concealed carry or buy four guns.
And this was specifically, they said, behavior towards women.
Right.
In the fire. So it's
and
just,
he threatened to shoot up the fire department, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was what Larry had said, I think, yeah.
Yeah. I think it goes to this masculinity, this idea of, and I see this a lot of these hot takes on Facebook and Twitter and people talking about it, but this concept of, you know, some men can't get over or don't know how to deal with when they're rejected. And in this case, this was just a really, really bad mix of all those things coming together
tragedy. The number of these shooters who have a history of domestic violence is striking. The percentage is very high. I don't know if that what to make of that exactly in terms of policy, but it's certainly, you know, and there's, of course, there's the police officer angle. There's also the emergency room doctor mm-hmm, angle, which is, mm-hmm. you know, and the woman, the young woman was a pharmacy. Was she a pharmacist?
She was a pharmacy resident.
I mean, these were all people who are in helping professions, and the ER doctor murdered in the parking lot, and so all these things come together to make it rise above the unfortunately common shootings that we have, even multiple shootings that we have in the country, in the city every day. So,
Dr. Tamara O'Neill, the 38-year-old emergency room physician. Then there was Dana Less, the first-year pharmacy resident. We've been talking to about Samuel Jimenez, the police officer, 28 years old. One other note about all of this, the Sun-Times picked up on it, and I noticed some of the national press did too, and that is that just 2 weeks prior, the NRA, commenting on the fact that a lot of physicians are opining about guns.
Stay in your lane.
Said they should stay in their lane. That became a hashtag.
I did just awful timing by the NRA to say that in a day later for this to happen in a hospital.
What NRA had good timing. I guess.
Yeah, right.
What a stupid thing for them to say.
Regardless of this.
And tell me, you guys would know more about this, but right, the doctors want there to be government studies of the impacts of gun violence in this country.
They want to treat it as that. They want to categorize it
they
as
want
that.
The CDC.
It's a medical issue.
And the politicians and the NRA have continued to stop that from happening.
Right. That is exactly right. And you wonder about why, of course, because if it became something that you could call an epidemic or, I guess, an outbreak,
exactly.
There would be different rules that would go to how you would deal with that.
This is how the organization that used to be called Ceasefire, I don't know what their new name is, but it was founded by Dr. Gary Slutkin, whose idea was that gun violence is a health hazard and it spreads in the same sort of epidemiological way that disease spreads.
I was at an event with the Cook County Hospital. I don't know if officials, I mean, I'll say, I don't remember the exact title, but they talked about how they can go back to a neighborhood where there's been a shooting and they will see a deterioration in mental health or physical health in that pocket affected by that shooting, you know, just by the anguish of it or the loss of income or whatever, but they can see the sort of spider effects of each and every shooting in this city.
There's a tweet this morning, and it said, so the government can get their hands around tainted lettuce. Nobody's supposed to eat romaine lettuce this week. And boy, we got the message and everybody's on board. But you say, okay, guns, you know, there's right. no nutritional value there. And it shouldn't be that difficult for us to come up with some sort of consensus, but we can't.
Well, I think we can. I mean, I think there is consensus out there on a lot of these issues, or at least a majority view. But that majority view can't get policy enacted because of the impact of the NRA and the cowards who hold office.
Okay, new topic now. In his ongoing quest to make Saudi Arabia great again, the president touted lower oil prices. Today, he tweeted, thank you, Saudi Arabia, but let's go lower. The most baffling thing to me, guys, about the U.S. official indifference to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist, is the logic of it. Never mind the morality or the fecklessness. We look so spineless in this case. Or even the exclamation points in Mr. Trump's statement that began with, the world is a dangerous place. It's the logic of it. He says, we can't afford to stand up to the Crown Prince because he might cancel military orders. Those are pledges. We don't have that money in the bank yet. We may never see it. The numbers are probably inflated, and we are in the power position in this case. Saudi Arabia can't go anywhere, at least not quickly. If they say,
well, his threat is that they'll go to Russia
or China, right. And in a decade, they'll have a new air force, maybe. But really, right now, they're fighting a war in Yemen, and they want and need American parts, planes, and weapons. They're not interchangeable with Russian and Chinese things. So who's got the leverage here?
I'm with you, John, because reading that, the head scratcher was just how blatant the argument was in his statement. This idea that, hey, I know it was essentially said, I know it's one guy.
It's transactional.
Think
transactional.
About how much money we would lose, and I just don't want to lose that money. I mean,
it's a mercantile.
Yeah, we've talked about right. that. Now he has these relationships, but he just stated it pretty plainly.
We have no values. Other than the value of money.
Well, he might have been in the Islamic Brotherhood. He's not a U.S. citizen, right. So...
What if where is the line? What if he were a U.S. citizen? Would Trump do anything then?
I think this makes it a different conversation.
For us? Is it a different conversation for
I
him?
Think so. There's this idea, you know, America first, but if you're only talking about economics, I mean, America is more than just an economic power, right? America is... ostensibly, it's supposed to be this international ideal that we're supposed to be not just an economic and military leader, but a moral leader in the world. And I just feel like Trump is squandering that.
I also feel
like the cost of doing so would not necessarily be particularly high for some of the reasons that John talked about, which is like, yeah, they're not going to be able to go and buy all the stuff that they want to buy from Russia or China right away, or maybe even in 10 years. They are customers of ours, and we have leverage over them. And we also have, I believe, a moral obligation in a case like this to do something about it. I mean, I'm not saying you bomb Saudi Arabia over this, but...
You stand up.
And
I mean, you don't say, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the words of the president. You know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
If I'm in the CIA, nothing I say or do for a career seems to matter anymore. Here again, the president is dismissing the intelligence community. They said, yep, the Crown Prince has his thumbprint on this. And the president says, maybe not.
I just saw this story and didn't pay attention to it at all on Friday, but I don't know what the title was, but the person who oversees the relations with Saudi Arabia or the Middle East resigned on Friday after this was all coming out. He or she, I forgot who it was. They came out and they were looking for a hard line on Saudi Arabia, and they wouldn't accept anything else. They were recalled back to to D.C. Something happened behind the scenes, and then they offered their resignation.
I think I'm much less conspiratorial than most people. But I don't think the president really cares about these plane orders. I mean, that may or may not happen. It's down the road. So then what else is there? Yeah. And, you know, and he was pampered during his visit there. He was, you know, had the flyovers, his picture on the buildings, right? His son-in-law has ties. He apparently has business ties to Saudi Arabia.
And they bought some of his properties. Didn't they buy a whole floor in the Trump Tower?
Well, he bragged about how much money he's made from the Saudis until it wasn't cool, and then he said he didn't make any.
A regular customer is a Trump hotel, too, by nationality. Saudi Arabia, top customer.
But unless the Saudis themselves, the royal family, are like, don't you dare admonish, don't you dare say bad things about us in the press, all he has to do, like Steve said, all he had to do was put out a statement saying, we do not accept this. This is something that we're going to look at strongly. And we, as the American people, America as a country, don't believe in it. All he had to do was have someone else write it for him.
I get the feeling that Steve's loading up a conspiracy theory for us. You said, I'm not normally a conspiracy theory guy, but...
It makes the most sense that he's worried about some personal interest because he doesn't...
Right.
I don't think worrying about the sale of missile or the planes really would trigger him there. I mean,
that's funny. I think that's a huge conspiracy theory.
Well, I think it is too, and that's why I said I don't usually say things.
But you're buying this.
I'm not saying I'm buying it. I'm saying there's as much logic or more logic behind that. And maybe it's not the money. Maybe it's the fact that they basically got on their knees when he showed up in Riyadh, and
projected his face onto a building.
Yeah, and so they flattered him so much that he's now in their
pocket. He said the crown prince five times denied to him. In strong words, five times he said, no, I didn't have anything to do
with
it.
Which is the same thing that happened with Putin, the same thing that happened with Kim Jong-un and North Korea. There's a pattern. There's a predictable pattern that's happening with the president and the way that he does these outlandish, crazy things. Like, I can't believe he did that. Well, he just did it 6 months ago and 6 months before that. My question, Lindsey Graham, Bob Corker, other senators, Republican senators have come out completely in contrast to what the president and the White House did. Does that matter anymore? I mean, do you think that there is bipartisan support to do something that will be in contrast to what the White House wants to do?
Well, there might be, but what are they going to do? They're going to pass a few sanctions or something? I mean, I would like to see it, but the Republican Party the last couple of years has been notable for the way these guys get up on their hind legs and they growl and then they curl up into a ball and start to purring, so.
I mean, the loss isn't whether or not they're punished. The loss is the moral loss that we suffered. And
congressional, I'm a little surprised you guys are dwelling on that. We have no moral equity in the world anyway.
Well, I mean, because of things like this. I mean, but we did 2 years ago. We stood for something.
Do you think we don't stand for anything anymore?
I don't think this tarnishes our image much more than it's already been tarnished by the fact that Donald Trump stood there with Putin and refused to call him out. I mean, really? Surprised you.
So I don't know this, but as an American, is that morality? Is that just something we believe? Because you go to other countries, or maybe you go to some of these countries that are in war, and they're like, the U.S. does not, you're talking out of two sides of your mouth.
Okay, well Steve Bertrand, travel. What does the rest of the world think of America when you travel in Europe?
I think probably more than ever. I mean, I think we used to think that the NATO allies looked to us for moral leadership. I don't think that's the case anymore, or certainly not as much so.
Well, another question is, what does this incident, this event, and Trump's stepping back from this, does it make the world safer in any way? Does it make Americans safer? Does it, as I believe, embolden dictators and tyrants all over the world? Like, well, we can do what we want. We can take journalists and kill them, and the U.S. isn't going to do anything about it.
You know, Rand Paul went down that line on Sunday. He said, Trump's thinking that this is putting America first. It's not putting, it's putting safety second, for one thing. He just found nothing but flaws with the logic and the morality and all of it.
Could I make an addendum? He says America first, but he means Trump first. What it means is if you are a dictator or a rogue nation and you want to be able to do this to people, kill journalists, what have you, then you need to make a good deal with Trump. You got to make a good deal. If you make a good deal and the American interests are involved, he'll look the other way on humanitarian stuff. He's done it with China. He's done it with North Korea. They don't even mention what's happening in China.
He's in love with North Korea.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to change subjects.
Before you do, Michelle Wolf, was the last correspondence dinner host, right? And they announced this week that Ron Chernow is going to do it instead. You have a Ron Chernow book.
The historian.
You have a Ron Chernow book in your office
I sure do.
The Ulysses S. Grant.
Doorstop, too. It's
huge. I'd give you $1,000 if you read it.
Yeah. I collect those books as souvenirs, but I don't really read them.
So Donald Trump went after Michelle Wolf, called her a so-called
bomb so bad.
so-called comedian said she's a so-called comedian, and I just lost it now. But I wanted to find
her response.
Her response.
She said, "Well, if I were,
I got it here." She responded on Twitter. She said, "I bet you'd be on my side if I'd killed a journalist." Right, and so that kind of wraps it all up.
Yeah, and you're really going to look at and blame the fact that the Correspondents' Dinner they're going with a historian instead of a comic on Michelle Wolf.
I think it's a smart move by the journalists to go with it.
I
don't know what you do with the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner. It's supposed to be funny, but how can it not just make things worse or make the press look bad?
Well, the thing is that someone like Chernow, he could. I don't know what kind of speech he's going to deliver.
What if he's just on fire?
But
if he's blue?
He could blister the president and not in this kind of way that late night comics do with roast, but he could just do a lot of he could do a very powerful, muscular, historically based speech about why this guy is.
And
so
I push back on Trump's assertion that tweet that she bombed the so called comic. She bombed so bad that they had to change it. I'm like, I thought she was hilarious.
Yeah.
Now it was very pointed and very political, but it's hilarious.
And it said things about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' appearance and things that may be weird.
So what?
He hardly did. He said,
God, you guys! Wait. I just gave you a drop of push. Back. Come
no,
on.
I mean,
pushback here, please.
So you're not, so we don't make fun of the way Barack Obama looks. That's wrong, but you can't make fun of the way Sarah Sanders looks.
That's right, Steve. In America today, women and men are regarded differently when we talk about their appearance.
I thought she was funny.
I feel really bad if your last name is Trump and you're listening to this podcast right now, because our next topic is, should we lock Ivanka up? Lock her up. Somewhere that chant's going to go up, and it's going to be positively delicious.
Yeah, are they the same, though, Eric? Are they the same?
No, they're not exactly the same.
They're
not exactly the same. I don't think she was dealing in... we don't know, first of all. We don't know for sure.
Well, that's the point I made with John yesterday when he was apologizing for Ivanka. that at this point... they could be the same, right? Because if we take this at the point where Hillary Clinton said, well, there was nothing classified, it was all personal, blah, blah, blah.
And they went deep
and then they went and found that it wasn't. And that's where we are with Ivanka
Trump.
We're
right now at the point where she's saying there wasn't. And it's hard to believe that she was actually dealing in that much in classified information. She was, an assistant to the president.
I didn't think it was that big of a deal when Hillary Clinton did it, frankly. So I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say it's a big deal if Ivanka Trump did it. But I sure would like to see some equal outrage from the people who did think it was a big deal.
I think that's the key. Is it's just the hypocrisy, the equal outrage. That's a great way to put it. If you're going to be outraged about one thing, be outraged about the other.
Well, but that point makes itself. You know, I'm directing this to Eric because I think I know what he's thinking. And that is...
You just answer for me, too, then.
I don't think Democrats should try and cash in on this. I think let it go. Let it go. Don't run this thing through the mill the way we did Hillary Clinton, because then you are just back at their level again. And we had an argument like this, similar when we talked about Supreme Court justices. But go ahead, Eric. I'll let you speak for yourself.
There is this issue
with
Hillary. Yeah, thank you. With Hillary, I mean, they were relentless about Benghazi. For what, how many months that was, and put her on the hot seat for 12 hours. And I mean, the relentless pursuit of her, and then how they just will just back off and with these other things that I think are equally or more scandalous, such as what the Khashoggi story. But I agree with John in that I think actually pursuing this, pointing out the hypocrisy is important, but actually pursuing it and working up this kind of umbrage that I don't actually think that many Republicans actually were upset about Hillary Clinton in her email, because there's no evidence at all that anything that she did leaked out, that there were any secrets that anybody got a hold of that was actionable, that anybody's life was put in danger. And I'm sure that's true here too, that it's important to underscore the necessity for security and so on, but the idea of locking somebody up.
You're talking about politics too. I mean, they knew in circles that Hillary Clinton was going to run for president, and so putting her through Benghazi, Ivanka Trump, she's not running for anything. Maybe she's on a short list for next president. I don't know what the deal is with that. But the concept being that she's not at the same level, so there was political points to win by putting the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, threw that ringer.
It's just shockingly naive, though, isn't it? Or ironic or stupid or whatever. But, I mean, that's why her dad is president, because Hillary used her private email, and she was using her private email.
You mean the Trumps don't think the rules apply to them?
I guess not. I guess that's what they must have been thinking.
There was some sexism that came out. I was reading a think piece about her response, Ivanka's Trump response was sexist, this idea that I don't know any better.
She said that?
That was the idea. That right. That's been their point.
She wasn't counseled the way incoming people are counseled on these sorts of things.
Just the defense of that and her and this idea that she's, I'm just a dumb daughter who doesn't know. And it's so garbage.
The entire campaign was about Hillary and her damn emails. Yeah, and Ivanka claims that she has no idea about this distinction between...
They think we're all stupid. Emails. They think we're stupid.
Does anybody want to talk about the mayor's race for Chicago and how that is shaping up? Justin, what are your thoughts about that?
I love that there was a poll that came out this week. It was from, I forgot the name of the consulting firm, but it was one that was used by J.B. Pritzker in the governor's race. It had 15% for Tony Preckwinkle, 13% for Susana Mendoza, 9% for Bill Daley, 6% for Paul Vallis. No one else registered. And I thought that was very interesting because one of the things that we found in 2016 about poll taking is that there's a certain structure and format and formula that polls will use. And a lot of that has to be calling landlines and finding different people who are already registered in the system, the way they do polls, right? Amara Enya's name does not come up. Nothing. Now, if you're not familiar with Amara Enya, she's the woman who is endorsed and supported by Chance the Rapper.
And Kanye West.
Kanye paid her debts, yeah.
I follow Amara Enya, and she was a guest in the download. I've known her very well, and they're not going to get a Amara Enya person on that poll. Calling a landline.
Did they not ask? Oh, they're not going to. Oh,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Just saying they're not going to get that. So,
and they did vote this November.
Yeah, right. So to me, it's just interesting that I still feel like there's an energy and a very interesting campaign that's coming up here. You're going to have two hardcore Democrats in the state of Illinois, Susana Mendoza and Tony Preckwinkle. A lot of familiar names, Bill Daley,
Chico,
Paul Vallis.
And then the question about
a young vote. A young vote, we talked about this the last time I was on, that came out in droves in November, more so than people who were 55 to 64. And so are they going to be counted? And will you see a movement that is not covered by the media, that's not in part of the established Democrat politics in the city of Chicago? And will that have any impact on what happens here?
You say it's not going to be covered by the media. Where will we see it happening before Election Day? I mean, is it going to be in the alternative web press?
Maybe. I'm thinking about the way that Amara did her signature gathering was they call them pull-ups. You guys know what that is? Like that's the sort of term, almost like a hip-hop term. Pull up. Hey, pull up at this party. Pull up.
Pull-ups.
And the concept being they'll have it at different parties, and the people who were gathering signatures, at the end of the day, they come in and they deliver their signatures, and there's a concert. And it might be Chance on stage. It might be somebody else. But the point being, they're playing to a very specific millennial set of engaged, I don't know if I want to call them voters yet, but engaged young people, college kids and whatever. And they're having, and you don't see these. That's not on the front page of the Tribune. I'm just saying there's something there that is not usual politics in the city of Chicago.
And if that support manages to coalesce, if that young support manages to coalesce behind Amara, then you do have the possibility that she would get into a runoff.
And
I don't actually, at this point, I don't know where the progressive vote is going to go. You know, people say that Susana Mendoza has this past where she's all tied in with Rahm and Speaker Madigan, and she used to be in favor of the death penalty, and that she doesn't have the progressive credentials to attract those voters.
She was the co-chair of the Emanuel campaign to reelect the mayor against Chuy Garcia.
Okay. So
it gives you an idea of where she was.
That's where she is. On the other hand, I just wonder whether what kind of support she's going to attract, because she's very dynamic. You know, Susana, she's got,
I like her. Yeah.
I do too. She's got you know, three times the energy of just about every other candidate in the race, and whether that's going to attract not necessarily maybe 20 somethings, but 30 somethings, and so on. She's what, 46, something like that.
Mendoza.
Among the youngest. So I mean, I think it's interesting. There was a forum on, was it Monday night? The forum, and it seemed to be Preckwinkle against Mendoza. It looked like those two seem like they realize that they are squaring off for a certain voting block that's going to be really critical. And the idea is to discredit one another. So, I mean, Preckwinkle's going after Mendoza for the things we just talked about, and Mendoza's going after Preckwinkle for her embrace of Jill Barrios, the Cook County assessor who got bounced.
I love it.
So
I just think it's going to be great. I love it. I think you still got Willie Wilson out there, who is very...
I mean... Willie Wilson is not going to be the next mayor of Chicago, but he may get enough votes to really be determinative in who's going to come in the first two places.
I don't know. I get really jacked up for Chicago politics because there's a lot of different demographics and a lot of different vote areas, and who's going to get the mayor's old stomping ground, which is essentially up the gut, downtown and up the gut on the north side of Chicago. Like, that's up for grabs now. Does that automatically go to Susana Mendoza, the voters in Wrigleyville, or do they turn to a Tony Preckwinkle? And what about the black vote in Chicago on the south side and the west side? Does that go to Tony Preckwinkle? Because she's a Cook County board. There's a lot of great... Willie Wilson, Lori Lightfoot?
Lori Wilson, African-American friend of mine was telling me that one of the problems, Lori Lightfoot is gay, and that this is something that does not necessarily play well among older African-American voters, that they are not going to, they're like, oh, I'm not so sure she's a lesbian.
Lori Lightfoot plays well in the gay community here, and she's already put in roots in. But I remember on election when it was announced that Tony Preckwinkle was coming out, I was talking to a friend who's a big part of the gay community here in Chicago and said, oh, Tony's in? You know, like right away, the idea that the gay community was lining up behind Lori Lightfoot was a given.
Yeah.
But then Tony Preckwinkle comes in, they go, we love Tony.
And her resume, Lori Lightfoot's resume is pretty impressive as well.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not a one-dimensional candidate.
And all of the conversation we just had, the old white dudes didn't even get mentioned.
We're talking about any men. We're not talking about any white people.
I just think it's an interesting time in Chicago politics to think that you have the front runners we're talking about, two women of color.
Who's exciting among the white men out there? I'm serious. I mean, I think Gary Chico has we're talking about resume, political resume. Gary Chico's got a ton of experience. I don't hear people like being excited about him.
He's the only. He's the Latino man, and you have Susana Mendoza, Latino woman. I just think I love it. I can't wait.
No, this is a case for ranked choice voting, which we had in Minnesota. And ranked choice voting is where you get to vote for multiple candidates. You could vote for five people for mayor. You say, here's my first candidate. And say it's Willie Wilson. But you really don't want to vote for Willie Wilson because you know he's not going to win. And why waste your vote? You don't with ranked choice voting. You get to vote for who you want. And then after they count all of the ballots, if Willie Wilson is in last place, every Willie Wilson vote goes out. And then they count your second vote, which could be Susana Mendoza, say. So now, even though you want to vote for Susana Mendoza as the safe choice because maybe you don't like somebody else, you know, you can in fact vote for the person you most want, be them a long shot, be them your Bernie Sanders, but you don't want to vote for Bernie Sanders because you know that'll actually favor the Republicans. It's the same thing with ranked choice voting is a very interesting concept, and they do that in Minnesota.
Do you remember, Eric, how we used to elect the members of the state legislature, the House?
Because I wasn't around, but
you weren't because
I was
a kid.
Three member districts, all right?
There were three.
Two member districts. Well, go ahead.
You had more votes than you did members you were voting for, or something. Or you could vote for three times. You could vote three times for one person, or one time for three people, or
two times for one person.
Right, and I think Pat Quinn was instrumental in getting rid of that.
Yeah. Right, which and I guess the idea. And again, I wasn't around because this is the '70s, right?
Yeah, I was a kid, but the legislature was huge.
Well, where were you? You're the oldest of us.
Yeah.
Where were you doing?
You were around.
I was in high school in the 70s.
You high school hippie.
My dad was a precinct committeeman. I was handing out Chuck Pengel stickers.
That's great.
Remember Jerry Joyce, state senator?
But the idea behind this, I guess Pat Quinn thought that it was too expensive. He had to pay all these legislator salaries. But my understanding is that it contributed to a lot of bipartisanship because you would have a lot of Republicans representing people.
They'd be in there, right? You're right, right.
So good. And you know, John, your point is really good. I think ranked choice voting is a very smart way to go about it. You could do that, and then you wouldn't even have to have a final runoff.
It's what some people describe it as that. It's a spontaneous or simultaneous runoff vote.
It's a simple runoff. On the other hand, it's going to be interesting when it comes down to the two who emerge. I'm almost positive we're going to have a runoff. And then when the two emerge from that, it's going to be really interesting.
I think they're all great candidates, and you know, they'll separate themselves, I'm sure, but it's a very healthy thing for the city of Chicago that there are so many candidates and good candidates that want to run the city.
Exactly. I heard so many people complaining during the gubernatorial race, like, oh, these two.
Yeah, not the case in Chicago.
This is the opposite of that.
This is going to be just a wild rumpus.
And I love it.
And it's going to be really interesting. I hope a lot of issues and I hope a lot of plans get
And I hope more than anything that because there are this many candidates that we don't get into to silos. where a candidate uses data and says, I'm going to win here, so I'm just going to stay here. I want to see, like Willie Wilson is doing right now, I want to see these candidates going day by day to different churches, community centers. I want to see them at the fish fries or the, you know, whatever sporting event, the Blackhawks game. I want to see them do the Chicago experience.
Which is
through
writing,
and through.
You want to see them writing checks for votes like Willie
no,
does?
No,
is that
no,
what you
no.
want to see too?
I want to see, but Willie Wilson has been another, he is going. Every week, he's going to different nursing homes.
Why are
he's
you
showing
so,
up in? I just think that's how you run a Chicago campaign.
If I'm
for
one of
mayor.
Those other candidates who's dedicated my career to being famous and successful, he doesn't belong in a conversation about the Chicago
all
mayor.
All I'm saying is he is doing a street level campaign, and I'd like to see them all do that. I do not want to see one of these candidates sit up top and be like, "We've got the data points, and it says that we don't have to do anything, and we just put another $1 million in, and we just put on some cartoons."
I think that what Justin should have said when we were talking about what he's grateful for, he is grateful for this mayor's
race. Oh, love it. He's
going to be so happy. This is his Christmas present, his New Year's resolution.
Here are our recommendations for the week. I'm going to go first. John Williams and WGN present a London and Edinburgh adventure. This really is my recommendation because I think there's great value in this and we're going to have a lot of fun. And I think the value, the good thing about a vacation is not the 7 days you spend on the trip. It's the 6 months that you get to think about the trip. The anticipation is itself really a nice thing. And so on April 26th, for 8 days, we're going to leave from Chicago, go to London, spend a few days there, take a first-class train ride up north, and then go to Scotland and spend a few days there. And it's with WGN listeners, and we've done the Bertrand trips before, and they're just fantastic. So if you want more, Steve Bertrand, travel.com. Steve's not even sitting here now, but I'm really looking forward to this, and I do recommend it. How about you?
I will also promote an event I'm doing December 2nd at the Chicago Theater Works. I am doing the Chicago Accent Challenge, the final tournament.
This is really going to happen.
So for a year's time, I've been doing segments on WGN Radio where people call up, and if you have the best Chicago accent, we ask you some questions, you answer them. And if you have the best Chicago accent, we give you pizza. And you get entered into the grand prize, which is $333. And we just said,
how much is it again?
$333.
$333?
So the perfect amount for the Chicago accent. And so I worked with the Chicago Podcast Festival. They asked me to do a show. And I said, I'll do it if I can do the Chicago Accent Challenge. So I got the candidates. I have special guests. Alderman Spisato from the 38th Ward, who is considered to have the best Chicago accent in all of City Hall, is going to be one of the special guests, and it's going to be Sunday, December 2nd, 6 p.m. It's like Bloodsport, the movie Bloodsport, without blood, instead Chicago
accents.
What's
the website? How can people go to see this?
Can we listen to this? Is it going to be live
streamed? Yeah, I'll tape it. I'm not going to live. Maybe I will. I don't know what I'm going to do yet.
They're giving us the wrap. You get 45 seconds.
Okay, real quick. I just finished reading the Incomplete Book of Running by Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he started, basically took up running seriously when he was 40, just as I did. And he's run about, I don't know, maybe more than a dozen marathons. His time was 3 hours and 9 minutes. I ran 3 marathons, and I finished an hour more slow than that. But it's a really interesting book. It's about his depression. It's about his divorce and what running did for him. And it's a good read.
That's this week's Mincing Rascals podcast. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Thank you, Justin Kaufman. Thank you, Eric Zorn. Thank you, Olive Garris. She produces the Mincing Rascals podcast.
I'm thankful. Yeah, thankful.
Yeah, no kidding. Now that you mention it, let's all go back and insert Olive's name in the beginning of that. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on the John Williams Show on WGN Radio.